The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But Dacrell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 170. This is another one of our Worldcon episodes, so you'll hear some audio differences from the normal episodes. The audio in this is much better than the sort of walk-by sessions, but that's largely because we're doing it in a hotel room, so we have a little bit more control over the audio, but you will notice there is some audio differences. The other thing I did want to mention is the episode comes from two audio files, which I had to splice together, mostly because we kind of got interrupted in the middle of the first segment when breakfast came, so you will hear a sort of very short, like 2-second blank space, and then we'll start saying stuff about, oh, we got breakfast. Yeah, that's basically just the point at which I've cut out all of the excess I could around the audio files, but there was no way to easily splice them together without sort of making it really weird. So just you'll hear that, but hopefully it won't cause any issues. But otherwise, thank you for listening to the show. If you have any questions or whatever, just let us know. You can send us email of that. All that's at the end of the episode. So, anywho, enjoy the talk with Nick Mamatas.
I have a special guest today, which is Nick Mamatas, who is the author of many, many novels and editor at Haikusoro, which brings in translated work from Japan. So welcome to my show in your hotel room.
Oh, thanks. So this is the Skiffy and Skippy show.
Yes,
no,
it is.
No, there's no Fanty here, right?
Yeah, because she's gone. She's dying in a hotel room right now.
Was it food poisoning?
No, she...
I mentioned this because Kat Valente has food poisoning at this convention.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, I forget what the name of the restaurant was, so it's not really useful advice. But there's a restaurant out there in San Antonio that you shouldn't go to.
It's poisoning people. Yeah. No, it's just that she had some alcohol.
All right.
Yeah, and apparently...
I had some alcohol.
Yep.
I had some... potato sake at the Japan party. I had some stuff at the Helsinki party. And I'm here.
And you're here.
I am here.
Well, since you bring that up, obviously there are like 8 bazillion bids going on for all kinds of different Worldcons coming up. But obviously Helsinki is one that's for the year after next.
For 2015, yes.
What do you think about that?
I think it's great.
Do you think it's going to happen?
No, I think Spokane will win. I think most fans are going to say, I don't want to go overseas 2 years in a row. And a lot of people are complaining that, oh, how do I get my books to Finland? Or how will I fly to Finland because I'm old and have a cane? And I think a lot of people will... Well, this is literally a real issue that if you're traveling a long distance. And there are some people who might have visa troubles because Finland isn't necessarily as open to the world as, say, the United Kingdom is.
Oh, okay.
So you may have to get a visa just to go in for the weekend. So, and I think because of London in 2014, people don't want to have too far ones in a row. Honestly, I would love it if Worldcon never went to America again.
Oh.
I want London, Helsinki, Athens, just keep going forward. And then
maybe once in a while
Cairo,
go to Canada.
Johannesburg, let's go everywhere. Shanghai.
I think that would be really great because on the one hand, from a World SF kind of perspective, to bring in more fans. However, I'm poor.
Yeah.
And that's the only reason I'm totally selfish and wanted in Orlando is because it's 2 hours from where I live.
And of course, but nobody else wants it in Orlando.
Really?
Because Orlando's terrible.
It is a terrible city.
It's a terrible city.
But Spokane's not really.
And nobody wants Disney, exactly. Yeah, Spokane's the Newark of the Pacific Northwest. But nobody wants a Disney-fied world kind
of. Okay, well that...
That's going to be an issue. Although it has a great airport and...
yeah, and there's
great
lots
transportation to
do.
There are many things to do that involve Disneyland.
Yeah, this is true. Oh, so it won't go there. That's sad.
So I'm thinking Spokane will win, but I would love to see Helsinki win.
It would be very interesting, if only just because, just to see, I mean, I imagine not a lot of Finnish people come out to the U.S. for cons at all.
Right. Although they have a great fandom over there, apparently, and they had at the party, in addition to a lot of the nice alcohol, they had reindeer pate.
Really?
Reindeer pate. Santa Claus brand reindeer pate. So I had that. They had Moomin animal crackers.
Ah, okay.
So much, yeah, that's really cool.
Awesome. So I know we were just kind of talking just a moment ago about the panel on the borders.
Yes.
With Madeline Ashby, and I think it was Walter Hunt, Dave Harvey, and Chris or something.
Chris something. Yeah, he's my favorite.
Yeah, person I don't remember. And since we both went to that, I want to get kind of your reaction to that whole panel.
I thought it was a pretty good panel. I mean, San Antonio's a border city, so it's like had a regional interest. As we were talking about, Madeline Ashby first up said, I don't want to have any racism on the panel, and I'll shut down, and I'll make sure you don't get the talk again. She will just spend the entire hour talking, I presume, she had to keep it from becoming racist, which is good. And I thought it was a pretty good panel. I think I actually like the programming here, even though, of course, I am blackballed from all programming here.
I know. You're totally just being, like, kicked out, which That's is right. ridiculous.
Well, my friend Mark Finn, who was involved, said, you know, he was aghast. He said, so Harlan Ellison can grow up to be his tit and get invited to do panels all the time. But Nick can't say that. Gee, some people in fandom have some problems with their social skills.
And that's what gets you thrown out. Right. But grabbing boob is okay.
Yeah, you can grab boobs. Yeah. You can wrap your arms around someone and say, come back to my place. You know, when they don't want you to, that's fine. You can show up and serve drinks at the next WorldCon. But God forbid you say that there might be something wrong with some fans.
Which is ironic, because exactly what you're saying is...
The proof is in my banning.
Well, that's unfortunate. But
next year, I think, if I go to next year, I was told that London will like me.
I think so, because the London fan is very different.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's... I wanted to say they're a little more open, but at the same time...
Everyone has... Yeah. No one's completely open. I'm like completely open.
Yeah, well, that's true.
You're not completely open.
No, I'm not. No, I'm probably a bastard at some point.
That's right.
But I don't get as much trouble.
So if somebody had a tit-grabbing episode, they wouldn't be on a panel. Maybe on the panel, they'd be like, well, why did I do such a stupid thing? That'd be a good panel for that.
Well, there is the panel coming up about stop calling it a kerfluffle.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, I think fans should stop using obsolete terms all the time. I think everything gets sort of diminished in that weird way by using these funny terms.
Like kerfluffle, et cetera. Kerfluffle. Yeah, kerfluffle.
Brouhaha.
And sticking fail on the end of everything.
That's also just aggravating. Failure is a perfectly fine word. That works totally fine.
Yeah.
Race failure is good. Now, race fail is...
Yeah. But it's catchy, and we can put it into a hashtag for Twitter. Okay, so really quick, just to kind of switch gears, talk about your book. So Love is the Law is out.
Mm-hmm.
It's not out.
Well, when is this airing? It's not out right now. I haven't seen a copy yet. I will tell you that it's going to be in comic book shops on the 25th of September and bookstores on the 8th of October. This is an artifact that is being published by Dark Horse Press, which is a very large comic book company with a very small prose imprint that I love. So they shoot to comic book stores first, and if you go to comic book stores, they'll often have like a selection of books about, say, H.P. Lovecraft or whatever the top comic theme novel is. I even have... my local comic shop, Fantastic Comics in Berkeley, even has some poetry collections about superheroes. not written by nerds, but like written by poets who just happen to embrace the idea of the superheroic as a theme.
Interesting.
So it'll be there first, and then the next week, next Tuesday, it'll be in bookstores.
Awesome. So since it is coming out through Dark Horse, and I'd not been familiar with them having a prose line, what was the kind of... How did that come about? Like...
Yeah. Well, years ago, they had an imprint called M-Press, which was really a dog's breakfast of books that didn't really work very well. They had a book about a fat vampire, which were, at the time of Sexy Vampire, selling really well. A book of Playboy interviews. They reissued a Harlan Ellison novella about rock and roll, which 50 years later is not really all that relevant to the state of pop and music. That was a good book. A Liz Hand collection, and a book about diabetes type 2 diabetes. So they had no idea what they wanted with that list. And then they wrapped up M-Press and said, we can not do this anymore. But one book they left was Lovecraft Unbound by Ellen Datlow, the anthology, which I happen to have a story in. And that became a hit. Because as it turns out, when you put your books in comic book shops and it has Lovecraft on the cover, many people will buy them. And comic book shops don't return books, so it's good to sell them in comic book shops. because they keep them forever. And they sold a lot of copies, and they said, oh, now we can do some more books. My story was my Raymond Carver H.P. Lovecraft pastiche, that of which we speak when we speak of the unspeakable. And I got to know the internal editor, Rachel Adidon, there, and we started chatting about the possibility of doing something in the future. I happened to be writing a book with Brian Keene, another Lovecraftian book called The Damned Highway. It's Hunter S. Thompson meets H.P. Lovecraft in the 1972 election. Or H.P. Lovecraft's world, I should say, in the 1972 election. I sold them that book. It did pretty well. And then I had time to do one more. And we were just chatting one day. Actually, what happened was my agent at the time had said, Nick, you got to write a YA novel. There's enormous pressure for everyone to write YA novels, especially if you're a male writer, who can write supposedly for boys, in quotes. So I said to my agent, you know what, I want to write something like Harriet the Spy. Except Harriet the Spy is now a punk rocker and into Aleister Crowley and Trotskyism, and it's 1989, and she's been sucking this guy's dick for to get sort of magical powers and political, you know, education. Then he shows up dead. He has to find out who killed him by spying in the windows of all the neighbors like Harriet the Spy does. Mike didn't say anything. He's just like a silence on the line on the phone. But then I tweeted that as a joke, you know, and Rachel, who follows me on Twitter, said, I would so read that. So that day, I sat down and at my lunch hour wrote the first 1,000 words. And I sent to her. I said, oh, this is really good. Then I got enthusiastic about the voice and wrote 8,000 words. Then, as usual, I put it aside and went to them and make a decision. Then it said, yes, they'll do it. And
here we are.
And it's my first crime novel. This is really more of a crime novel than a science fiction or a fantasy novel.
Yeah, and that goes to something that you wrote on your blog some time back, that you were quitting genre.
Well, I'm quitting this genre for some other genre. I'm quitting science fiction and fantasy to write more crime fiction and to write more avant-garde fiction, too.
Okay. And tell us a little bit about why you're making that change.
Well, partially because of the things we were discussing in the pre-interview about fandom.
Mm.
And I've never really broken out of the small market that is sort of influenced by fandom, but writing for anthologies, I can be some primarily short story writer. So you can't become a famous short story writer or a successful, monetarily successful short story writer.
Yeah.
And my novels tend to be short and kind of weird. So they're not a series of 7 books about a woman with a vampire boyfriend and a werewolf boyfriend, but they're not a series of 25 books about a guy who is a commander of a spaceship who, you know, is killing the insects, hive mind communists of other planets. And I really started enjoying crime fiction, which is very interesting that I started writing a few years ago as sort of an experiment, and it's really quite different because all the things that I use as crutches, saying, oh, well, here's some magical thing can happen now that explains everything. It actually has to make sense all the way through. So it's really challenging stuff, and I stopped feeling challenged by writing science fiction and fantasy and horror so much. So it was a good challenge, and I said, you know what, let me try this. Of course, mystery fiction and detective fiction and crime fiction is dominated by the series as well as anything else there, you know.
Yeah.
Series of The Cat That Solves Crime, series of The Haberdasher Who Solves Crime is by looking at people's hats. But there's also in the noir element, the noir section of crime, there are plenty of single standalone novels, and I've been reading a ton of noir. So now, let me give that a shot. So my first book that sort of did that was Bullet Time, which is sort of a fantasy noir about a school shooting. Now this one is almost completely a crime detective story with maybe one scene or one chapter where the supernatural may have occurred.
Mm.
Or it may have just been a really unreliable narrator, or it might have just been a dick slather with the LSD that led to the woman ingesting it and having an experience, depending on your own point of view.
No, but all of those are perfectly valid.
Yeah.
Yeah, and interesting ones, because I particularly like unreliable narrators as a teacher. Yeah. So I like to trick my students and then be like, why are you listening to this guy and think this person's telling you the truth?
Yeah. And of course, every first-person narrator is an unreliable narrator, including ourselves in our own lives.
Yeah.
We're not reporting what happened. We're reporting our experiences of what happened. But of course, some people are more unreliable than others.
Absolutely, yeah. Hopefully I'm a reliable teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I may be misleading them down terrible paths. So this particular book, you've mentioned it's like Harriet the Spy if she were a punk rocker, which is very, very true, because from the first page, the character's voice, I was thinking almost like it's like a punk rock version of J.D. Salinger.
Mm-hmm.
Like just that kind of really, like, we're just throwing out a lot of things that are happening, and she's talking about all this stuff, but she has this really sort of rough, like, just direct, hit-you-over-the-head kind of a voice.
Sure.
And I guess a weird question to ask is, you know, how does this character come to you? I mean, what was it that you were just sitting down and you, like, just started going, or did, like, something happen where that character came out?
All my novels so far have been in the first person to a certain extent. Sometimes the first person of a species of collective spiders, or a first person of a telepathic kid who is like an omniscient first person. And I've written many stories in the third person, but the novel's always been first person, because I feel that I can propel that long. I'm trying to work now in a third person novel. But I just had this vision of this woman. And of course, inside noir, like inside fantasy, there's the idea of a kick-ass female, a new kind of character who can kick-ass. But I wanted someone who would more legitimately be a kick-ass female, who would actually be, on given her experiences, really almost sociopathic.
Yeah.
And of course, it's hard to write any noir story about a female these days, especially a female punk rocker, without being compared to The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and the other books of the Millennium Trilogy. But of course, it's not from her point of view. It's from this male point of view.
Yeah.
That's sort of a, or some, or more of a, it can be some mission of crimes, because it follows her very, very vaguely as she goes through all of her IKEA furniture and all her gear, right? But I want something closer than that, so we can see from the inside how this person works. And the first line, the first sentence is, "I am a fucking genius," which I think is a great way to determine, to write, start a story about this person, because the question you have to answer in a first-person narrative right away is, why does this person think I want to hear this story? And why she thinks you want to hear the story, because she's a fucking genius. She can tell you all about the secret history of Long Island and her family and this guy, Bernstein, who was killed / suicided, and what happened to the world at the end of the Cold War.
Yeah, and in that the first chapter, actually, it starts, as you say, you know, I'm a fucking genius, but the last line also has that in it.
Yeah,
which is a nice way of framing that, that she's going on this kind of rant, talking about all the stuff and the fact that she's providing services for Bernstein.
Yes. But I'll also tell you that, I mean, Harriet the Spy really was a strong influence. Actually, if you read this book and The Long Secret, which is the sequel to Harriet the Spy that takes place on Long Island, you will find many structural commonalities.
Oh, interesting.
Including the mystery of The Long Secret, which was, of course, someone leaving behind Bible verses, and who ended up being the person who does it, who was surprisingly close to the narrator, that kind of thing. So even though I was thinking about that time afterward, I think, you know, this is a lot like The Long Secret. I guess I really like that book, because, again, I did love that book as a kid.
Almost like Harriet the Spy grown up.
Yes.
A little bit. Yeah, become a punk rocker. And one of the interesting things, that, and you've mentioned it already, you know, talking about the sort of political climate, and you'd mentioned the Cold War, but also things like Trotskyism.
Yeah.
And I'm really curious, because that, honestly, that, at least in my reading, those kinds of themes, Cold War shows up, but nobody talks about, like, Trotskyism or communism or any of that stuff, unless it's just, like, these are the bad guys.
Yeah.
There's no, like, nuanced approach, and it almost never shows up. Mm-hmm. And what was the impetus for you to actually talk about that?
I kicked around Trotskyism for a few years, actually, and some Trotskyist groups are crazier than others. They're all pretty crazy, because they're all quite small. So when you're quite small, you have no real interaction with the outside world, so you form sort of cults, cult tendencies. And I was really interested in this idea of the Spartacist League, which is really known as sort of the really hardcore, super orthodox, super crazy Trotskyist group. And I was wondering, how would this sort of somewhat naive woman end up doing politically after being exposed to punk rock and being exposed to all these ideas, and wanting to escape Long Island, which is very stultifying? Mm. Would she embrace these extreme ideas? So embracing both Crowley and Trotsky at the same time in these extreme ways, it's just really interesting, because they're both sort of perennial philosophies that never quite succeed in what they're trying to do.
Well, that's another thing I was really curious about, is the Aleister Crowley, and I know so little about Crowley. He's sort of like a magic-y kind of guy.
He's a historical figure, a late 19th, early 20th century figure, primarily in the early 20th century, who became a media sensation for claiming to be the Antichrist and the Great Beast,
and
for having orgies in the really fastidious early 20th century, late 19th century United Kingdom. And he's really had very influential on pop culture. So you'll see him everywhere, Beatles records, Led Zeppelin.
Really? Oh my goodness. That's going to ruin some music.
Sabbath. And, you know, he's an interesting guy, and kind of a smart guy, too. But obviously taken with his own magical ideas, which are basically hermetic magic, hermetic philosophy, taken to an extreme. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that a lot of kids have a little episode with. They'll find some Crowley in the bookshop and go, "Oh, I want to have magical powers too," and read all the stuff. And of course, this stuff is really impenetrable and philosophical, and often depends on the sort of learning you no longer get in American schools about knowing a little bit of Latin, knowing a little bit of Hebrew, knowing a little bit of Greek. So people, I found that people tend to steal books from libraries. This is something that I found out working in a library, that all the old Crowley books from the teens and 20s, so they look old and have drawings in them, are routinely stolen from libraries. So I always thought in college, who's stealing these things? And why don't they give them back once they read it and see how nonsensical and weird it is? Because it's certainly not satisfying them, but they like to have them on the shelves. So I said, well, what if somebody read these books, actually tried to make sense of them and try to take them really seriously? And I know a few people who are really into Crowley, whose blogs I read, and seeing their points of view and their worldviews is really interesting to me, so I sort of try to integrate what I've seen from these people. And essentially, to them, it's a religion.
Okay.
You know? Certain groups of Crowleyites even have prison ministries, which have not gone well. I think one prison ministry ended up really highlighting this one guy as a model prisoner, thanks to Crowley and Thelema, and they ended up like killing some girl or something. So that didn't really work out very well for the prison ministry. So just like an interesting subculture. I love interesting subcultures, so it seemed like something that could, would happen. Yeah. Also, a lot of punks are anarchists or have vague pagan beliefs. But I want someone to be harder core than that, so anyone can be a vague pagan or a vague anarchist. You know, I remember a great anarchist scene that some guy was complaining about the oppression of school and how he was being punished unfairly for the so-called crime of setting his desk on fire. And I thought, well, what if somebody was like a little bit more politically astute than that, but not so astute they didn't end up with like more rational positions. So Trotsky and Crowley seem really good. They also are opposites in a way, since Trotsky, of course, is a Marxist and a materialist. Crowley claims to be scientific as well. He claims to be sort of a theory and practice of magic with the K, and it has certain definitions, and he tries to use hypotheses to create these metaphysical or at least psychological effects. So I thought the two of them together would be really interesting. Because, of course, we all have these ideas that don't fit together. None of us are hyper-rational. We all think we are irrational, but we all just...
Some of us do.
We all just have ideas that we came across because we raised our kids in a certain way, or saw something on TV,
yeah.
Or came from a certain family, or had a certain theoretical experience from reading a book, or a certain practical experience from living and being treated in a certain way, and we cobble together some set of ideas.
Yeah.
But it's one set of ideas that we cobble together to be more extreme and more obviously ill-fitting.
Ill-fitting. Well, that's actually really interesting, the kind of materialism or rejection thereof. And you were talking about the Cold War. And what is it for you is fascinating about the Cold War as a period, I guess?
Well, I'm 41, so I grew up during the Cold War. And I went to college during the Cold War. In fact, I went to college in September 1989, and I was majoring in political science at the time. I ended up getting a triple major, but my first major was political science. And the first day, we sat down and said, okay, here's the textbooks, here's the syllabus. Please scratch out these two textbooks, because we're not going to use them anymore, because they're now obsolete. They became obsolete over the summer, when the Berlin Wall started collapsing.
Oh, wow.
So these were like the future of the Cold War, and you know, the bilateral world, and it all became irrelevant over the course of the summer.
Wow.
So we were literally scratching out things on the syllabus, and we're not doing that lesson, we're not doing that one. Forget about that essay. We'll read this one instead. I hope something comes up in the next couple of months. We can add, you know, in some journal that we can throw in. So it was a really great changing time, and this is the notion of the end of history.
Yeah.
That liberal democracy would now, you know, proceed uncontested throughout history, which of course has gone to shit immediately with the rise of sort of radical Islam as a political potent force.
Yeah.
So that moment, that was a really triumphant moment that that had in it, as Marx says, the seeds of its own destruction, right? Because we're like, oh, this is going to be great. They don't have to worry about anything anymore, then, of course, something else has to emerge as an antithesis to the thesis of liberal democracy.
Yeah, it has to have... And, of course, we do a good job of creating our own
right. Others
to fight against. Yes. That was one of the things that was kind of hinted at a little bit in the border discussion,
yes. Where
I don't think they ever explicitly said it, but it seemed like they all were thinking that, where almost to some extent, like, Mexicans become this... like a scapegoat for
some
other fear that we have.
Yes, absolutely.
And a stupid idea anyway, because they're... Well, whatever. But it's all weird. And that's actually really interesting because, you know, the Cold War, 89, and then I think 91 is like the final official collapse.
Right, that's when they tried to what they would call the right-wingers, which of course would be the most left-wingers, the most communist, because the political spectrum works on your relative position, not your absolute position. So the hardline right-wingers brought out the tanks and tried to take over, tried to reverse Gorbachev's reforms, and then Yeltsin emerged as a figure, as a sort of a capitalist figure, to for people to rally around, and they got rid of the last vestiges of the communism. and of course of the Eastern Bloc, then we saw the Soviet Union dissolve into the constituent states, and what was left of the Eastern Bloc was all itself, Romania, you know, was probably the last, if I remember correctly.
Of course, now it almost seems, well, at least on a cursory glance, it almost seems like it's kind of going backwards again.
Well, not toward communism, but certainly toward autocracy, certainly toward...
Yeah.
There was never really a strong democratic vision. Democracy never really matured in Russia. You know, the few years, a few months of Kerensky, then the October Revolution, which was in its way profoundly democratic. Then, of course, that fell apart right away and became, you know, this is sort of the Trotskyist vision of it. Right? It became, depending on your point of view, 1921 or 1928 or 1935 became counter-revolutionary because of Stalin and the Five-Year Plan, or because of Stalin and the purges, or because of the collapse of the alternative parties to the Bolsheviks, depending on, you know, what you want to, where you want to pin the original sin of the Russian Revolution. So there's no surprise there, but of course it's happening in the U.S. as well. I mean, many of the things that people were shocked at in the 70s that Nixon was doing, or that LBJ was doing in the 60s with the war, are now perfectly legal. And the extreme left position of the possible is like, well, we feel real sad to torture these people. We feel real sad to have to spy on your telephone calls. Or we feel real sad to have to kill citizens with our flying robots.
It is really weird from my perspective, because I consider myself fairly liberal. Mm-hmm. And when I hear things, I'm like, that's fucked up. Let's not do that. And then people that I consider fairly liberal are like, yeah, that's okay. Like, it's for our safety. I'm like, fuck that. That's not for our safety.
Well, there are two kinds of liberals. There are the liberals who support liberal ideals, and the liberals who support the liberal state. And I think these days, most liberals are people who support the liberal state. That is, they are in favor of war when a Democrat says we should go to war. They are in favor of suppression of civil liberties when a Democrat says they are in suppression of civil liberties.
It's that partisan kind of thing, because that's right. That happens also with the other side. They support almost anything the Republican says, and then becomes Democrat, and it's like, no!
No, that's terrible now that you're doing it, yes, exactly.
It's like, and everyone's blaming Obama for the NSA, and I guess, like, true, he could have stopped it, but I don't know if he can, I don't know if he has that power, but of course, that program comes from the previous era, and it's like, why was...
But he also helped expand it as well.
Yeah.
And he's sitting there defending it.
Oh, so he is defending it.
Yeah, so it's certainly not as though he's, you know, I just can't do anything about it. I wish I had more power. I wish I were the president. Oh, I am the president. He's saying, absolutely, I want to hear your phone calls. Absolutely, I want to see what you guys are talking about.
Yeah, I also like when he...
What are you wearing? Oh.
I like when he says, this is a conversation we need to have. And my first thought is, we couldn't fucking have the conversation until somebody released the documents us. So if it was a conversation worth having, you should have given us the materials to have the conversation.
He meant this was a conversation worth listening in on.
Fair enough. And then I think it's interesting because, you know, the Cold War is its end point, but then, you know, that's hailed as a big triumph. Like, the U.S. has won. You know, but after that, we also get more crises. South Africa is only a couple years later is they finally reverse apartheid. Mm-hmm. And it's this... like, huge moment. And of course, even during the 80s, I'm talking because, like, I know a little bit about South Africa. Like, just the violence. Like, it was a system that was about to collapse into revolution and civil war. And de Klerk has famously noted that one of the reasons he was making the concessions and changing things, even though I don't know if he fully was on board for everything, one of the reasons was he's like, these are our options. We have civil war and millions die, or we do this.
Right.
Which one's the better option?
Absolutely.
So, but it's one of those crisis moments where everything has changed, and you have all of this.
When the bilateral world falls apart, obviously a lot of more things pop up. Even today with Syria, really the whole thing's now a proxy war between the U.S. and Russia and China on the other side. So a lot of the issues that are coming up that seem like, oh, they're gassing people, or no, it's actually the rebels gassing themselves. They can bring the U.S. in. It's sort of a common conspiracy theory, are really all about a reshuffling of geopolitics.
Yeah, and the U.S. trying to keep its paws in the Middle East desperately.
So we're really working on selling my book.
Yes.
Yeah, people are really really engrossed in this McLaughlin Report stuff, saying, oh, I really want to listen to this Harriet the Spy book now. I definitely want
Well,
did you read it? Did you finish reading it?
I haven't finished reading it.
Good job, podcast.
Hey!
It's a 54,000-word novel, by the way. It's quite short. Anyone can read it one sitting except for this guy.
I'm sorry. I told you this would be like a loose discussion, and yeah. We'll have the proper interview where I get all of the really tough questions.
Great.
Yeah, because I think that it'll be a little bit better when I'm able to sit down and not have Worldcon like hitting me in the face.
And when Jen is here, because she finishes books.
Well, she's usually here, and then I'll have her, and you know she'll have her own questions, and then we bounce off each other.
Yeah.
And she's not here, and so she's fucking up my game.
Yeah. Are we back?
Yes, we're back.
We're back. We're full of pancakes and waffles.
Oh,
and we were talking about how Sean does not read the books before he podcasts.
That's not always true. As you're making it seem like hurting my heart.
Well, I'll tell you, my last book came out last year called Bullet Time. And I was given a bunch of online interviews to do with people who had not read the novel.
So they even tried.
They didn't even try. They give me the generic question they ask everybody. He's like, what scene was the hottest to write? Like, you know, not the hardest, the hottest. Like, because it's all about sexy, slashable characters. And if you know anything about my work, which apparently you don't, because you read my books either,
Sean,
you know there are no sexy, slashable characters in my book.
I don't know.
That's true. It depends on your taste, I suppose.
Fan fiction can make slash out of anything. Well, when we do interviews, when we do proper interviews, like where we're like sitting down and we're talking about the book, we have like four stock questions, and those are the questions we ask everybody. It's like, you know, where can people find you? Like, you know, like where are you going to be? What have you got coming out next? You know, what got you into writing if you're new? And like, we might ask you to describe your book. Mm-hmm. That's about it. The rest of the questions we make up that are based hopefully on what we've read in the book, with rare exception where like we've had some where we've scheduled an interview and like we didn't get the book till like 2 days before and we're like, we don't have fucking time to read it in 2 days. You know, we all have jobs, but like I hate interviews where it's like that, where it's just all the stock kind of question stuff.
Absolutely.
So just like you could just email them, like we don't need to do a podcast for this, just email the stupid questions.
And the questions are too stupid to answer. Like one question is, you know, popular, I find, is like, how did you get into science fiction, fantasy, and horror? And the answer is always the same. I read it as a kid.
Yeah, which is why I'm changing that question now, because I've gotten so many answers that are similar to like to that.
The real question is, why do you either stay with it or come back to it?
Ooh, that's an interesting way of reframing it. Yeah.
Because everyone reads science fiction as a kid if you're reading any books at all. If you're like a little smart kid who likes to read books, they're going to do science fiction books or fantasy books or books about dragons.
Yeah.
And most people stop.
Yeah.
Right? That's why they're on 25,000 people at Worldcon, because most people stop. Now, most people stop reading entirely. Most people don't read books in the U.S.
Which is depressing.
Yeah. But those that do read books, like the average reader reads 2 books a year, which is either the most popular novel of the year, whether it's Twilight or Freedom by Jonathan Franzen, and one book that's nonfiction either about Jesus Christ or carbohydrates. Jesus Christ good, carbohydrates bad, unless, you know, if you're looking at do a book.
That'll change in like another decade. That's they'll switch it around.
All right, finally. It's my time now.
Yes. Considering we just ate waffles and pancakes, so...
And then the people who are regular readers tend to, you know, stick with one genre, so maybe read romance fiction or maybe only read mysteries.
I don't like that either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we were talking this the other day. We were talking about, like, music. And you would ask me, do you like gangster rap? Yes, I do. Do you like My Bloody Valentine and Shoegaze? Yes, I do. Do you like country? Yes, I do. But I hate most of all of them.
Yeah.
I just like the best 3% of all of them.
That's
always been my reading. I like the best 3% of, or my version of the best 3% of science fiction, of fantasy, of horror, of literary fiction, of avant-garde fiction.
Yeah.
You know, not so much romance, only because there doesn't seem to be much of a leading edge of romance other than stuff that becomes erotica, which I do like. I like to read pornography and erotica. The best 3% of this.
Yeah. side aspect of this is that there have been some discussions. People got really offended when they were basically asked, you know, you should try to read a little bit more broadly. Like, even just within science fiction, you know, don't just read your, like, Jim Butcher. Go try this author from over here who's doing some similar bits but is doing some different stuff.
Yeah.
And this pushed against trying to, like, broaden your horizons. And I think that everyone should. And you shouldn't just read genre fiction if you're a genre fiction reader. You should read stuff outside of it. Read a history book. You might find some interesting shit, you know?
Well, at the same time, broadening your horizons is what teachers tell students. So that's why you're seeing this pushback. Well, if you want to be a good person, you should read widely. Well, you know, I know plenty of wonderful people who've never read a book in their lives, and I know plenty of terrible people who read books constantly.
That's true.
Yes. So I should be divorced from the idea of being a good person. But if you find someone who's an aesthetic, who considers himself or herself an aesthetic explorer, saying, I love looking at brave new worlds, or I love finding interesting characters, well, then say, okay, how about this?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. There's no rocket ship on that, or... I don't know, something occurs in this novel. I only like novels where things never happen. I teach a class, and often we have to go through the first day, the difference between literary fiction and genre fiction. And this is a genre fiction class for writers. Mm. And they often have integrated this idea that genre fiction is secondary to or an appendage of literary fiction, and inferior in some ways because it's about entertainment and not art, or it's about story and not sentences, and they always have plenty of counterexamples. Yeah. But then I ask them, oh, what kind of literary fiction are you reading? Oh, none. So you know what happens in a literary fiction novel? Let's say about World War II versus a war novel about World War II. Do you know?
Well, not about World War II. I'm reading Sun Also Rises for my class.
Sure.
Which is World War One. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. After World War One.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
So a literary novel about a war takes place after the war, and people read about the war in letters.
Yeah.
Or talking to survivors, veterans. Yeah. And a war novel, that takes place during the war.
Right.
Yeah. And right. You get a battlefield scene, that kind of thing.
Right, there's a lot of fights.
Yeah. And that happens with a lot of literary fiction. Literary fiction is often about where something occurs in the story at all, it happens in the form of somebody opening a letter or reading about that event.
Yeah.
As opposed to...
Because a lot of literary fiction, at least in my experience, yeah. it tries to get at the character rather than what would be the plot. Yeah. Especially with Sun Also Rises, I keep telling my students, it doesn't have a plot. You'll notice that says, no, well, it does, but it doesn't.
It has a series of events that occur. Yeah. It doesn't have a conflict and rising action to a climax.
Right. It doesn't have the magic triangle.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're essentially suggesting that the distinction is kind of pointless, because of course you can write genre fiction that's literary. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the obvious examples they teach in high school, like 1984, it's both, literary fiction and science fiction.
And somebody like Jonathan Lethem, for example, was writing science fiction.
Yes.
Then after he got a big hit with his mystery novel, Motherless Brooklyn, it was such a transcendent book, or in marketing terms anyway, that it moved to literary fiction. And wrote his old book to literary fiction as well. So he went from court to Harcourt, and now his books have always been literary books.
But they're weird, and they've got like genre components.
Yeah, and many people are easily able to navigate literary fiction. Most people who read literary fiction aren't reading realism because they don't like crazy ideas. They love crazy ideas, like anything else. They read Borges, they read avant-garde stuff. They read things that have, like, even The Corrections has a science fiction element to it with its drug that allows you to experience things differently.
Oh, interesting. Direct all, okay.
So they're used to that sort of thing. It just needs to be integrated differently than otherwise.
Absolutely.
Aside mainstream genre fiction. I mean, I remember these slightly differently. So you can really just take the covers off and put new covers on, people will read the books differently. I find this, that's why I have to, in my class, I tell people, put the genre you want this story to be read as on the front page. Otherwise, people get really confused. I had a woman once write a story about mysterious happenings in an office. And everyone's like, oh, mysterious happenings, this must be a mystery. Someone got killed in an office. But the first chapter also included people like checking out their cleavage a lot and putting on a lot of lipstick. And I said, what's going on in that office is an orgy. And finally, at the end of the workshop, we asked the lady, well, what's going on? She's like, hey, how did you know? It's orgies. I was trying to keep her surprised. Like, there's no surprise here. Everyone's just too sexy for a mystery story.
So it was an orgy.
Yeah, yeah.
So and that was the mysterious happenings.
The seven dicks at once. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. It's like 50 Shades of Grey, almost.
So if you read widely, you can tell what's going on right away, because you know the protocols and the tropes of a certain genre. If you happen to read widely, you can be at sea right away. So it can be very challenging for anyone.
Yeah, that's something I was just wrote a review for the re-release of Delaney's...
Fados?
No, one of his critical collections. Not The Jewel in Straw, but the other one. Starboard Wine.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the ideas are obviously some of the stuff that's in Jewel in Straw, but one of the things he talks about is teaching science fiction to people who've never read it before.
Right.
Having to like retrain their brains for the language, because he's really upset on this language thing. And that's always been true, like something like Neuromancer, where it starts with the
Sky's Television Channel.
Yeah.
Which means nothing now.
No, it doesn't. It's true. But it is one of those lines that if somebody never read science fiction and they read that, they go, what the... What?
Yeah.
You know? And it's like...
It sounds like bad literary writing. You saw it in a Jonathan Franzen novel, you'd be like, what the...
Yeah.
Who's thinking that? If that's the character not thinking that, it's just like the narrator, that makes no sense.
It doesn't, but at the same time, it's a shocking moment. You realize, I'm not in the normal world anymore. I'm in some sort of other place. And of course it is. And that's Neuromancer's I love that book, but...
And now that's what people like you are going to talk about now. We were talking during our breakfast break, how here at WorldCon, people still say, have you read Stranger in a Strange Land? Have you read Heinlein? And if you're sort of hip and new, and with it, you only talk about 40-year-old books like, or Slytherin, Gwyn, The Dispossessed, or Dahlgren by Delaney. Yep. But now that you're the young whippersnapper here at age 28, perhaps one of the youngest people not in the nursery school at all, you read that Neuromancer? That's something.
Yeah.
So that's 1984, so it's only 30 years old.
Yeah, well, and
by the time we were 20, 40, people were like, you ever read Old Man's War by John Scalzi, the Grandmaster?
Well, there might be some truth to that.
Yeah.
Or maybe they'll be talking about you.
That's not going to happen.
Like, have you read that book, Sensation?
That'd be that guy. Remember that one guy we actually barred from being on panels of programming at Worldcon? Because he called us dopes and social simpletons?
Yeah, shock.
If only he had grabbed a tit, then he'd be on programming.
Oh, yeah, now we're back to something previous, yeah. That, as everybody knows, that's okay. Tit grabbing's fine.
Yeah. If you're Harlan Ellison, you can grab all the tits you like.
Well, see, that's
what I mean, people did complain about it, obviously. It wasn't like it passed everyone a remark upon.
But and he was forced to, quote-unquote, I'm using quotey fingers, apologize.
Right.
His version of apology is a non-apology, but that's okay.
I apologize for the tit that fell in my hand somehow.
It was a joke between me and Connie Willis. And I'm like, well, nobody else got the joke, guy.
It could be Connie Willis, who was legitimately and obviously certainly
offended by it.
Appropriately offended.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Boot grabbed on stage and not fun.
That's not good.
No, but your genre fiction, this idea that the separation and there is some separation between the types, like literary fiction tends not to be quote unquote popular, although it can be popular, but not in the writing sense. And then a lot of genre fiction is, of course, written. At least from a publishing perspective, it's published to entertain people,
right?
With some exceptions to.
Love is the Law. Did you find what you read of that Love is the Law entertaining?
I found it entertaining. What I've read, yeah. I don't know if I find it entertaining in the same way that if I were into reading Star Wars tie-in fiction, right? Because that's more straightforward. Like here's action and lightsaber fights, and it's plot, very plot central. It's got all that stuff. This is not that kind of book.
Yeah.
It's more I want to say brooding, but I'm not sure if that's the right word. But
it certainly ruminates a lot. It ruminates about her experiences.
Absolutely. And that's one of the interesting things, I think, for me, is the setting and the kinds of the weird politics we were talking about earlier. But it's the character, the way in which she's she'll be talking in one paragraph about one thing, and then she's brought in five other things. It's very much almost, not you don't write it as stream of consciousness, but there's that component.
It's memoiristic.
Yeah.
There's also, the noir structure is the structure of the confession.
Ah, okay.
So I don't know if you read a lot of noir fiction.
I don't.
How do you start? You should broaden your horizons.
I will,
Sean.
I will, absolutely.
Yeah. I thought of Goodis, Goodis. He's really the king of noir, as far as I'm concerned.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Goodis, he's the one.
Okay.
A lot of people say, Reed Chandler or Hammond. I don't think because of those guys noir. They're hard boiled, I'd say.
Okay.
Noir is something else. Noir doesn't even require a detective or a cop. Often it's about a person who made a mistake.
Okay.
Or a person who went up over their head in some situation. So Goodis, Jim Thompson, those are I'd recommend as the noir kings.
Okay, so that's what you would consider that the noir is
the noir is about crime and social trespass, not so much about law enforcement. Put it that way.
Okay. So you don't think Private Eyes necessarily are part of noir, at least not.
They can be, but they often aren't. They're often what people call noir is really more hard boiled, which is like a tough cop with tough decisions to make and tough problems, and tough broads, and that kind of stuff.
Do you think of noir as aesthetic?
Yeah.
Okay. I ask that because one of the, when we talk about something like cyberpunk, and one of the arguments I make is that people think of cyberpunk now as being an aesthetic genre because it is now.
Yeah.
But it wasn't always.
Right.
Or at least my contention, it wasn't. Right. It was very much a political shift because of where it derives its history from, the punk movement.
Yeah.
But with noir, it's kind of the kind of question I'm curious about.
Well, that also derives from the post-war malaise, First World War II malaise and that kind of stuff before the 50s took over. Also sort of a reaction of the 50s in a lot of ways, the dark side of the 50s.
The dark side of the 50s?
Sure. Yeah. You don't make a lot of Levittown to get a lot of free mortgages and education without somebody going wrong.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
You don't win a Second World War without a lot of wounded people, a lot of psychologically wounded people coming home.
Absolutely.
It's like we talk about Vietnam War, Iraq War, people having flashbacks. Of course, after the Second World War, of course, if you're liberating concentration camps or fighting on the in Okinawa, you're going to come home really damaged.
Yeah.
And of course, there was more social support for those people when they came home. If they have the GI Bill, they can get houses. You could have it could be a, like my grandfather was a maitre d' in a hotel, in a restaurant as well. And he bought a house on Long Island, and he had four kids. Wow. And he bought a new car. And you can't do that today working in a restaurant on Long Island.
No.
Maybe way. Wyoming, you know.
Yeah.
If you find a restaurant in Wyoming, it's not, you know, Taco Bell or something.
Yeah.
So there was more possibility for you to have the semblance of a normal life, but there's a lot of dynamite kegs underneath those facades, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, and of course,
a lot of noirs about that. Yeah. On some level.
Yeah, and of course, PTSD is not—it's not a declared an actual condition until Vietnam. Right? People called it shell shock.
Yeah.
You know, if you came back fucked up, you were just shell shock. Yeah. You'll get over it. No big deal. It's like,
or maybe
no,
you won't. Maybe just be in the corner drinking brandy. You
know, but they didn't know what to do with those people. Yeah. A great novel example is, I mean, everyone's read it probably, Slaughterhouse-Five, where the main character actually goes to a mental place for soldiers who've like lost their minds temporarily. And some of those people who are in there don't ever come out because they've lost it. They've snapped, finally. And you know, now we have supposedly ways to deal with it, but I say supposedly
it's
because...
pharmacological ways. It's just tranquilizers, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, basically. So, not fun. Yeah. Not fun. So, okay, so the noir genre, and you're saying Goodis was a great example.
Yeah.
Not so much what is known as the hard-boiled, so like Chandler and...
Hammett.
Yeah, Dashiell Hammett was another one I was thinking. Who else would you recommend in the kind of noir genre?
Contemporary, I like Megan Abbott.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
The woman, Sarah Gran, another who also has a little Susanna of supernatural stuff in her latest series, the Clair de Wet series. It's about a book called Detection, about a French existentialist detective. And if you find this book, you become a detective. You can't help it. And it's sort of a weird world where everyone's like, the most important people in the world are detectives. If you're a detective, because you're in this weird subculture, and it's a subculture of detection. So like, imagine like Nancy Drew was real. And the Hardy Boys were real. Not that they're actually real in these books, but imagine that kind of world where, you know, you'd be stumbling along the, you know, working at whatever school you work at, Sean, and you see something, and you're like, I'm going to find out what's going on. And of course, normally if you saw something, Sean, you just sort of run away and maybe tweet about it. You
know? Yeah.
You wouldn't do anything, right? But now it's a world where people will, yes, do that. And in the latest book, Claire DeWitt and the Bohemian Highway, which takes place in Northern California, at one time, Claire DeWitt goes up to the Oakland Hills to find the Red Detective. The Red Detective, who has a gnomic sage-like character, who is a homeless person who solves crimes among the homeless, essentially. And he says that, you know, who's the missing girl? He's like, there's no missing girl. Like, in every detection case, in every case, there's a missing girl. Find the missing girl and you'll find you know, what's actually going on. So it's about this idea of revelation as opposed to ratiocination. So it has this sort of supernatural, almost uncanny element.
Yeah,
too, which makes it pretty interesting. I think maybe interesting in World League Fantasy would also enjoy these titles.
There's also, when you were telling, because I've not read it, so obviously you're telling me the kind of story, but this idea in fantasy, you know, the tropes. Fantasy has specific kinds of plots and structures.
That's right.
And here you're telling me like the same thing. Like, you know, there's a missing girl in all detective stories, so you have to find her to find the right thing.
Right.
So it becomes almost like a quest.
And it becomes a reference to the idea of the quest.
Yes, exactly.
Without being the sort of corny fantasy, which I've seen so many things of, so many examples of when I was working at Culture World, where someone's like, it's the princess and the prince, and they have to go kill the dragon. Because once upon a time, those stories were compelling, so you're just making reference to them, attempt to make them compelling again. And even walking through the dealers room, I saw so many space operas that were sort of pastiches of space operas.
Mm.
You know, Biff Lightyear, or you know,
Biff Lightyear.
Captain Zapperlot. and his, you know, girlfriend and his funky robot pal flying through space and the space adventures. So it's very much like 50s style or 40s style space opera or space opera on television.
Kind of stuff, yeah.
Or even things like Captain Midnight on television, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Ironized and then de-ironized again. Right, so it's a pastiche of a pastiche. It's a non-ironic pastiche of ironic pastiches of the original. So really, the head is really crawled up the ass of a lot of this stuff. And we see the same thing with steampunk.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in steampunk. Yeah, there's some good stuff being made in it, though, which I really... Because I'm writing a...
My steampunk's different! Is that what you're going to say?
No, I'm not reading. Sorry, an essay. No. I don't know if I've written any steampunk that's different. Honestly, I don't think so. I would never make that claim as a writer. I just can't. I don't think I would make that. But we're writing an essay, and we're actually writing about Jeter and Moorcock. And I found out, like, Moorcock, nobody writes essays on Moorcock's stuff. But one of the interesting things we found is that there's all this stuff that, like, there's the trend in steampunk, which, like, you know, it's...
It's like Doctor Who, Victorian Doctor Who. It's about a guy, and he's got a female companion, and they have, like, a little bit of sexual tension, but nothing ever happens because it's Victorian age.
Yeah, and it's set in the Victorian period. There's almost no mention of the fact that it's an imperial era, you know, and there's all this politics and, you know, gender politics, etc. But there are some books that are actually being written that are now taking that into account, and those are the books that I'm most interested
like,
in. Mary Robinette Kowal, I did not even expect it. She doesn't write explicitly steampunk, but her sort of like Jane Austen-y kind of stuff, when she was talking to us about it, was talking about, she's bringing in all these actual historical events.
Did you read it yet?
I've not read it.
I've not read it either, but I'm just saying, I'm asking you what you've read.
What I've read. Okay.
Because then we all know, right?
Yeah,
as opposed to having
yeah.
a description of it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Kowal's books are fine. I'm not saying they're not good.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that's... Because one is not Victorian, right? He's writing Jane Austen, that's pre-Victorian.
Yeah, it's pre-Victorian,
yes.
Yeah. Well, that's steampunk, it's almost half of it's not even really Victorian anymore. Like, Moorcock, his stuff is considered steampunk, but his books start after, I think it starts right, like, a decade before them, and then it skips over it. Like, so it never actually takes place in anything Victorian.
Yeah.
But it's called Steam. But okay, so an example that I know people really hate this book.
Okay.
But a book called Storm Dancer by Jay Kristoff. One of the things that
Like the Chinese lady? Or is that one?
I believe it's a he kind of it's a secondary fantasy world that's kind of steampunk that has like mixtures of Japanese and Chinese culture.
Okay.
And while
people hate that.
There are a lot of people that hate that book, and it's got a lot of its own problems. But one of the things I really liked that it did was. It took seriously the idea that, you know, there are ways that people produce steam are not like, you know, we just, like, boil water with, like, magic and then, you know, you get steam. Like, you're burning coal, you're doing all this shit that's actually horrible for the environment. So there are actually moments in the book where you literally see the dirty, nasty city that would be produced from this. And so it takes that idea seriously. And there's also some imperial elements for that. They're now being... there's a Singaporean anthology of steampunk... the title of which is now escaping me. It's only an ebook now, unless you want to pay like $4 billion for the print copy and have it shipped internationally. But there's that. There's people writing that. There's also the there's two collections of lesbian steampunk by edited by Josel Vanderhoeft. And the first one has it has a bunch of stories, but one of them is I believe it's an N.K. Jemisin story, which actually. Takes place in the main character's from Haiti, and she's actually like an agent for Haiti. But it's become its own instead of like in our world where you know Haiti, quote unquote, went to shit.
Right.
Unfortunately, it actually becomes its own power. While it can't rival the United States because of size, the United States doesn't fuck with it.
Yeah.
And so it actually has its own kind of political interaction with the world, which I found really fascinating.
Yeah, that's cool, yeah.
So
I wrote one big steampunk story. It was called Arbeitskraft. That's labor power in Germany.
Okay.
It's about Frederick Engels. And Frederick Engels trying to organize some matchstick girl employees at a matchstick factory. And people liked it. It was reprinted a lot of times. Didn't get anywhere like award-wise or anything. People were like, wow, this is new steampunk. But I always thought, well, that's what steampunk was. Because I was like reading, like, you know, Gibson and Stirling's Difference Engine and stuff like Jeter and stuff like that. It's always been sort of that grimy underside, that grossness, right? That
it's supposed
class struggle.
Yeah.
So when the new steampunk emerged, I thought, this is not really steampunk. I mean, it's steam fiction. There's no punk involved, though. Or it doesn't have that connection to the idea of the rebelliousness of punk.
Absolutely. Yeah, it completely... It did it because, as we were talking, I think, even before the podcast, the idea of, like, hashtags didn't exist when they made the word, but it is that has that hashtag side of it, because you just shove punk at the end.
That's
so now there's, like, coal punk and, you know, all these kinds of things, which are catchy terms, but, but they don't...
But there's nothing punk there. It's just the opposite of punk.
Yeah, because they're just adventure stories that are set in worlds that happen to have steam.
Alternative history,
Yeah. Which has its own fun problems, but okay, so one of the things I did want to talk to you about, I don't We haven't talked a lot about it. I think when you were on the show last year, I think you
sure,
were.
Sure, 2 years ago, last year.
Yeah, something like that. We talked briefly
when
about
when Jen was there. What a great show that was.
Yeah, you bastard Jen for not being here. We talked very briefly about Hikusoro, but obviously we're at Worldcon and you, a bunch of people from Hikusoro have been here, and there was actually a Hikusoro party, which is awesome.
Thank you.
I had to eat, I ate part of a fish thing.
Yeah, it was a...
still had eyes on it.
Yep.
Which I really shouldn't be bothered by, but I guess it was a little shocking at first, because usually...
Well, what you missed is that the better version of that item is when the fish are full of eggs.
Oh!
But you got the cheap version. We can only afford the egg-full version. So,
see, like, that seems weird to me, in other countries it's not. Like, I have a friend who's teaching in South Korea now.
Well, do you ever eat cod roe or caviar? That's the same thing, right?
I've never eaten caviar. Never.
No kidding. I'm just surprised. But, yeah.
I'm poor. But, I can't afford caviar.
Like, caviar. But like, it's a delicacy. So a delicacy that's expensive and that sort of thing. And it's supposed to be, like, the fancy thing. But it's like a cheaper version of the same. So that's, you know... It was so repulsive, audience, that he actually put his hand to his mouth when he went, oh! It was just as if I had shown him something terrible. Instead of just mentioning that fish have eggs.
I don't know if I could do
it. So, Hikusoro is here. We have Toen Jo here.
Yep.
He's a novelist. A very interesting, he has a cross-genre novelist in that he won one of Japan's most prestigious literary awards. And in Japan, there's even a greater division between literary fiction and genre fiction, where what they'll call true literature is one thing, and popular literature, genre fiction, is something entirely different, and never the twain shall meet. So there are very few figures, like I say, a Kurt Vonnegut figure who crosses over or Orwell. To a certain extent, Haruki Murakami does that. And he's always a controversial figure because he does that. You know, often people read Murakami, he's like, oh, he's very Japanese, here, like, this is a Japan bike. And in Japan, he's like, wow, this is some strange, weird Japan, it's like the Japan we live in. You know, because we're interested in jazz records and that kind of thing. And chasing chubby girls around, and finding sheep and that kind of stuff. But Toen Jo won not only a prestigious science fiction award, like the Japan SF Award, like winning the Nebula. He won a major literary prize, sort of like winning a Penn Faulkner Award. Quite a National Book Award, but like almost on that level. And that crossover never happens. And he's here with a book called Self-Reference Engine, which I've described, because I wrote the copy, as Borges and Lem... meets high mathematics, you know, and it's hard science fiction, but not what we consider hard science fiction. Because hard science fiction, when we say hard science fiction, we basically mean right wing science fiction. We mean with the cold equations, rationalism that forwards the plots. So you can have hard SF that has, you know, Dyson spheres and FTL and also things that make no sense whatsoever. But as long as you have a rational guy saying we got to make hard decisions, throw the girl into the airlock, hard decision, and you know. Have almost libertarian sensibilities, that's what we read as hard SF. It seems tough, right? But the hardness is not from the fidelity to the laws of physics, but fidelity to some notion of what rational people do.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
He's the exact opposite. The world is crazy, inexplicable, but if you know some higher math, it kind of starts to make some sense.
Yeah.
That's about these giant corpora of knowledge that emerge from computers and start taking over after the event. But they themselves are confronted by hypergiant corpora of knowledges who then talk directly to humans because the corpora of knowledge is interesting enough to talk to. And it's set in a series of 22 short stories that have to be read in order. But it can also be read in a different order, which we have a map for in the book.
Yeah. And that was the thing that really set me off. I read the back cover and I was like, well, that's interesting. That's kind of cool. And then I looked and I was like, there's a freaking map in here of how to read this.
Yes.
And that was really, really cool because I love that kind of...
I said, Enjo, son, we need a map. Because I'm editing this book. I'm talking to you. I'm talking to the translator. We need a map.
And it's cool. Yeah. It's going to be... And I think
that's
awesome.
Called a map mapping maps.
A map mapping maps.
Yes.
Who was it that was at... he was at ICFA. Jedediah? Something. There was an author who... I feel really bad for forgetting his name. He was experimenting with basically note cards with paragraphs on it.
Was it Jim Barry?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was really interesting because he actually read it and he shuffled the order and then read the story in this order, and it seemed really interesting because you just flip them around and you just change the order again.
Other things like that. The classic Cortazar's Hopscotch is a novel that works that way. You should check out. And you can read chapters in certain orders. Or straight through, and most people don't read it straight through. You play the game of reading it here and here and there and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
so it's happened before, and but it's certainly unusual enough that it's interesting.
Absolutely.
And this is actually the opposite. I was really worried that people would read it as a short story collection. Now, most people read short story collection anthologies in order.
Yeah.
Some people, like myself, don't. I always read the short story, then the longest story, then some other story that seems interesting, and I always read in random order. So for people like me, it's that I needed to have this map, and I needed to have instructions for the book. And it says, this is not a novel. It's not. This is not a story collection. It's not. This is self-referencing. It references itself, and the idea of destroying itself and creating itself all the time, using these mathematical and philosophical principles. So really, it's a series of in-jokes with physicists. So if you really want actual hard science fiction, written by an actual PhD with physics, writing about the philosophical issues and really funny, weird things like a woman digging up all these Freuds, Sigmund Freuds, in her basement.
Ooh.
And every Sigmund Freud is dreaming one of the other stories in the book.
Oh my goodness.
You know, things like that. Then this is the book for you. And we've had some really great reviews. People are like, well, this is really mind-blowing, or this is like, one reviewer said, this is either the best book of the year or the worst book of the year. Still working on it. And that was the review. And he went on about like how crazy it was and how thrilling it was and how out of the insane and nonsensical it was. But that's what really the bleeding edge of science should look like. It should be confronting the strangeness of the universe.
Absolutely.
And this is what that book does. So I strongly recommend Self-Reference Engine. Toe, that's T-O-H, N-J-O, E-N, capital J, intercap J, O-E.
Okay. Yeah, and definitely check it out. And I suspect... This is one of the reasons that I want to talk about Hakusoro is I probably haven't told you yet, mm-hmm. but next year it's the World Cup, so that's exciting. Mm-hmm. This show we're doing all World SF, with some exception of some Americans. We'll like include a couple,
yeah.
But the majority
that's part of the world, yes,
yeah. Well, it is part of the world, yeah. And that's kind of how we thought about it. But so one of the things that we would love to do is A, want to have you on to actually. Mm-hmm. Have you talking about Japanese science fiction,
sure.
since you're working in it, and maybe get some other people, but also, if possible, to get interviews with Japanese authors, which I know can be difficult because some don't speak English, but...
Well, we can have a translator. We have Nate Collins, a translator here at WorldCon, who's helping Toe and Joe out, and Nate Collins is one of our great translators. He translated the MM9, a great scientific hard SF monster book, a kaiju book, sort of like Pacific Rim without the robots, but just scientists trying to figure things out. That was by Hiroshi Yamamoto. He also did our Metal Gear Solid novel. We did a tie-in novel, Metal Gear Solid, for Metal Gear Solid 4, Guns of the Patriots, written by Project Ito, a great fan of the series.
That's
so,
right,
yeah.
Yeah.
So Nate Collins is here. He's also doing our new translation of Battle Royale, the famous novel. We're translating
really?
That for the 50th anniversary. And of course we're here, why we had a high sort of party is because we have a Hugo nominee.
Yes.
Not a Japanese author, but last year we did The Future of Japanese, an anthology of stories combining Western authors writing about Japan and Japanese authors writing about anything but Japan.
Yeah, and Ken Liu got nominated.
And Ken Liu, with Mononawa Wari, and he's an American of Chinese descent. Or maybe he's Chinese-American, but I presume he's an American of Chinese descent. I don't know if he's immigrated as a child or whatnot. But I'll tell you one thing. When my boss, Masumi Washington, who's Japanese and had immigrated here in the U.S., read the story, he's like, are you sure he's not Japanese? And maybe it's a Japanese wife? Because this is a very Japanese story, so that's why she was very excited about it. Mm. I like the story. I thought it was a good story. She was
I did
over
too.
The moon for the story.
Yeah, it... There were two stories, or there are only three in the stupid list, which is some stupid Hugo rule. But there were the two stories, Immersion by Elliot de Bodard and Ken Liu's
Mononawa Ware.
I'm going to say that wrong all the time. And both of those stories, like I deliberated for like 2 weeks on those
and
stories.
And so who got your number one book?
Remember
those pancakes I bought you a minute ago, Sean? Oh, you did.
I gave it to de Bodard.
She's but all right. We like her too.
It really was. It was for me. Like I sent them both a tweet and I said, "Next year, you guys can't write good stories at the same time," because it was the hardest decision on that whole ballot.
Yeah.
Because Ken Liu's story, like the way I think of it, is like Elliot de Bodard is very cerebral.
Yeah.
Like her stories are that way. Him, like he just pulls at my heartstrings.
Yeah. He's very nostalgic.
Yeah.
In some ways, he's actually too nostalgic. I'd say I think he's too nostalgic, which of course is why he went so many Hugos and Nebulas, because people love nostalgic stories with the Hugos. If you ever want to be a Hugo nominee, Sean, what's a nostalgic story about a toy rocket ship?
No.
Or about about watching Frankenstein for the first time, or the first time you saw Stranger in a Strange Land and had an orgy, and then things are different now. That kind of thing. Write that, and you'll get a Hugo nomination. Yeah.
But he got it for the Paper Menagerie.
That's an enormously nostalgic story.
It is true.
That is drenched in nostalgia.
But it's a beautiful story.
Sure, I'm not saying it's not good. I'm just saying that... I would also hope that Ken Liu should just start moving past nostalgia.
I would also like to see him write a damn novel.
I've been trying to get him to write me a novel, Frank Masuno. Because even though we do Japanese science fiction and translation, we're also starting to work on doing some Western authors with Japanese themes. So one of our books we have released is Catherine Valente's The Melancholy of Mecha Girl, which collects all her Japanese-themed short fiction and similar poems as well.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
That was another example. People were sort of saying, well, why did you break your rule of not only Japanese? I'm like, well, my boss wanted me to. My boss, Masumi, the Japanese reader, said, these seem like authentic Japanese-style stories that gets Japan mostly right. And we made a couple changes here, and they're like, well, that kind of fox does not exist in that northern latitude, so can we have been a white fox instead, you know, a red fox? And these small changes.
Yeah, just
some spelling changes, but really the culturally, metaphysically, Japanese people like Catherine Valente's visions of Japan.
Really? So, and this makes me wonder, because since you edit and you're like the Superman in Hagasoro, that if you're starting to sort of branch a little bit, this suggests to me that the venture is going very well.
On some level, it's going very well. On another level, honestly, to be perfectly honest, it's much easier to sell a book by an American author in an American bookstore.
That's true.
Yeah. But also, we're doing really good things and are branching out. One of our first novels that we put out called All You Need Is Kill by Hiroshi Sakurazaka.
Okay, yeah.
It's a war novel that made some news a couple of years ago because we had a script written for it, and we sold it to Warner Bros. For $3 million.
Holy cow!
Which was unusual because these days spec scripts don't sell like that. So it was really, that was big news. And then we got Doug Lyman. He did Mr. and Mrs. Smith, you know, one of the Bourne movies. And then we got Tom Cruise as a star. Now, of course, Tom Cruise is not an 18-year-old Japanese boy, so the movie's very different.
Yeah.
It's not going to be called Edge of Tomorrow. But I will tell you that despite any sort of problematic issue with whitewashing or whatever you call it, when a Japanese or Asian character is replaced with a white character, which is upsetting, I will tell you that it sold many more copies of this Japanese book than it would have sold otherwise.
Interesting.
So to the extent that this whitewashed or different movie is good is because it's basically a gigantic commercial for the book.
And you'll probably sell.
We're going to sell a zillion copies of this book now.
Yeah. I haven't read that particular one yet, but I'm going to have to do it just so I can yell at Tom Cruise when I go to the movie.
And maybe you like it. Maybe you just like a different experience. Who knows? Maybe it's good. The funny thing was, what I was going to tell you now, is that we also do a comic book based on the novel.
Oh, okay.
An American-style comic book, which I wrote the script for.
Oh.
And the funny thing about the script was I was told, be sure you don't make changes that are similar to the changes of the movie. I said, oh, great. Does that mean I can read the script? No. Well, can I see some footage now? So you want me to guess what the movie will be like and not do that? Yes.
What?
So that's the day job. That's part of why I decided to write the script myself. To get us to an outside freelance writer saying, well, we have to look at it really closely to make sure it holds to the novel, so you can't do any changes. Japan will also look at it. The licensor will look at it as well. And you have to guess what the movie's going to be like and not do that.
That's so weird.
You can imagine some people going, maybe I'll do something else for you guys some other time. So I wrote the script myself, and my coworker Joel became my editor. You can edit yourself. That's not appropriate. And we had a great artist, Lee Ferguson, who's done some stuff with DC Comics, and Miranda Mercury, a great comic book about a black superheroine in the future for people like, diversity and really good comics.
Ooh, Miranda Mercury, check it out.
Check that out. And the comic book's coming out in May, and we're doing a mass market version of All You Need Is Kill. So that'll be called Edge of Tomorrow, formerly published as All You Need Is Kill.
Okay. To celebrate.
For the movie. Yeah. Then after the movie's gone, which I hope will be gone after like 3 months, we can sell tons of these books, then we'll bring back the normal version of the book.
Okay. Well, yeah. That movie's like next year, right?
June. It was going to be next March, but then Oblivion did so well that said, oh, Tom Cruise is back.
Did it really do as well?
Yeah, it did super well. For a March movie, that did really well.
I thought it didn't do as well. I saw Oblivion. I thought it was actually a pretty decent film.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good.
You know, it was.
It's like every other movie I've ever seen. But it's a good version of that movie.
It was visually well done. Yeah. I know people hate Tom Cruise because he's weird sometimes, but.
But people love him too. I mean, he has. When Tom Cruise came to Comic Con, which was a surprise, and that he would come to Comic Con for Edge Tomorrow, people exploded with glee. So I think a lot of people are like, oh, Tom Cruise, I hate him, he's a Scientologist, he's short, I don't like him. Oh, he's here! He's my favorite, I love Top Gun! I love everything. So
he's a decent actor, though.
He's a good actor.
Same with Matt Damon. Yeah. Matt Damon's amazing, too.
Yeah. Ben Affleck's terrible.
Oh, we're going there now, are you?
Well, one of my favorite movie critics was called The Filthy Critic. He's an anonymous, I don't know if he's still around, but an anonymous web critic. and he used to call Ben Affleck, Ben, I can't act, Affleck. And Matt, my friend Ben Affleck can't act. Damn it.
Well, yeah.
So yeah, Haikusu is doing well. We're doing comic books now. He came like this. Okay. He might be doing another one, I hope. We're doing crazy books like Toa and Joe's Self-Reference Engine.
Yes.
We're going to announce in a couple of days. Great ghost story collection we're doing about the Edo period of Japan.
Okay.
Which I'm excited about. By Miyuki Miyabi. He's done several other books for us, including Aiko. Castle in the Mist, which is a tie-in novel for
That's right, with the really pretty cover.
That the cult classic video game. We don't normally do a lot of tie-ins, but we did tie-ins when a real novelist did them, and that's a really important book, like Metal Gear Solid and like Aiko. Because some of the great things coming out that I can't talk about because you have to like, you know, go through all the rigmarole of having it released with press release first, then talk about it. But yeah, things are going pretty well.
Yeah, and so we've got a lot more coming, and that means that I'm going to definitely have to poke you.
That's right.
To make that possible.
And you're actually going to read the books. I'll send you the books. You get to read them.
I will, and I'm going to read the book fully and when we do the proper interview.
That's right, yeah.
Yes, I will, I swear.
Right, yeah.
But that would be great, and if we can get it so that there's a translator there so we can talk to people who don't speak English,
sure.
That would be really great, too. That's
I mean,
tell
Joe
story.
Just because I'm English, but it would be probably easier to do the
with a translation.
Yeah.
That would be amazing. Oh, it's going to be so awesome next year. It's going to be a big year.
Who else do you have lined up next year?
I don't have any specific people lined up, mostly because I don't know publication dates, but I know we have Stephanie Salter. Who's a Jamaican author. Tobias Bickel is going to be on, who's also a Caribbean author. I am definitely going to have a translator of science fiction into Hebrew. Who's going to? I talked to him here, and we're going to get him on to talk about that. No, Didi. I'm probably going to butcher the name, so I won't say anymore. And if Lavi Tidar releases a book, I'm going to get him on there. Which means if he's listening, he needs to release a damn book.
I'm
sure
it's like 4 books a year, so something like
yeah.
That, yeah.
So hopefully something weird as hell like Osama, because that book was awesome. So
that was a great book.
Yeah, and then I mean, basically the announcement at this point is this: now we're going to start pushing people we know who have connections that we don't have, and there's a publisher.
Well, this would be a good convention to go to as well, because this San Antonio convention has a great Spanish language and Spanish language issue track.
Yes.
So definitely go to some of those panels and try to find a translator. Or if somebody knows, or an editor, or that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I'm going to be talking to some. I know some Brazilian fan, like Fabio Fernandez, etc.
Great.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. So, I've been sitting on it since like June of last year, because I didn't want to mention it.
So this is a podcast that I'm the guest on, but I got an exclusive from you. I've been interviewing you about your podcast.
It's not quite exclusive. Some other people that know.
Oh, okay. But now it's being broadcast for the first time. That's the place.
Perhaps. Did we talk about it? I think we mentioned it when we were with Bacal, but we didn't talk about it this much.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was mentioned.
Okay.
So you got the spiel.
So you got the tease. Toby got the tease, and I got the
You got the full spiel.
Full scoop.
But also because you got connections.
Yes.
And so I'm going to totally mooch.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. Perfect. Love's Not the Law.
Love
is the law, excuse me.
You didn't even read the title.
You're just going to rag on me every time I fuck something up. It's not right. Love is the Law. That'll be coming out...
September 25th in comic book shops, October 8th in bookstores.
In bookstores. And we will be talking to you... Is it right... I think it's in October. Or is it end of September? I have it on my schedule at home. We're talking to you. All I know is we're doing...
Oh, I thought this was that.
No.
Oh, okay, great. Oh, so I'll be back.
Yeah, you're coming back for a proper interview.
Oh, great. Okay,
I
look forward to that.
Yeah, I'm going
to
actually read the whole book.
I can't wait to
talk to Jen. Yes. She has to be there or I will smack her in the head.
That's right. Don't do that.
Well, she deserves it a little. It'll be nice.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. So that'll be out. I think this will probably drop before that. So people go get the book before you listen to the interview.
You haven't had enough of this already.
Yeah. I also recommend Sensation. If you like what you hear about this book, Sensation's got some other kinds of weirdness. That's the one where you have
hyper-intelligent spiders.
Yeah.
Are the narrator. So it's a first-person plural narration.
Yeah, and it's really fascinating, and I like that one a lot. And obviously, Bullet Time was fairly recently.
Yeah.
And then The Damned Highway with Brian Keene.
Yes. And he's also, as we mentioned, the featured Japanese, the anthology did with my day job with my boss, Masumi Washington, as the co-editor, and which features Ken Liu's Hugo-nominated, and I hope Hugo-winning, You'll find out this. We're talking about the Saturday morning, so I guess we'll find out tomorrow.
Yeah.
Hugo nominated story. Mononoke Owari plus great things from Bruce Sterling, To and Joe, Toby Hirotaka, Kikuchi, Hideki Kikuchi, who is very famous here for Vampire Hunter D and
One
Called Amnesia, that kind of thing. Plus, the return of Felicity Savage. I don't know if you've heard of her, Felicity Savage. She was huge in the 90s. I found her. We have a new story from her, first in a long time that wasn't been on Kindle. You know, that wasn't self-published. Catherine Valente has a great story in there. So definitely check out Future Japanese as well, please.
Yeah, get that one. And basically just buy everything else by Akasura as well.
That's right. Just go there and just buy all 35 of our titles.
Yeah, our listeners are rich. They can afford all of them. Yeah, but lots of great stuff. So so thank you for... I figure we're kind of winding. So
yeah, this is it.
Yeah. So but thank you
bring
for
bring it home,
talking.
Sean.
I will.
Thank you. The Skippy and Skippy Show.
The Skippy and Skippy Show. But thanks again for talking with me and spending all the time, and also for breakfast.
You're welcome.
So a very expensive breakfast. And we'll see everybody next time.
All right, great. Thanks.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I pass in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.